This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. Today's guest is The Gutfeld Show and Fox News contributor Kat Timpf, whose new book, You Can't Joke About That, Why Everything is Funny, Nothing is Sacred, and We're All in This Together, is a massive bestseller. I talk with Kat about her life as a stand-up comedian and contributor to magazines like National Review and websites like Barstool Sports, what it's like to be an unapologetic libertarian at Fox News, and how her mother's untimely tragic death convinced her that humor is a powerful tool to make society better. This episode was taped live in New York City as a Reason Speakeasy, a monthly unscripted conversation with defenders of free speech and heterodox thinking. Go to reason.com/events for details on the next one. Here is the Reason interview with Kat Timpf.
Kat, thanks for joining us.
Ooh, yay! No. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Kat is a regular on The Gutfeld Show, the most popular late night show on TV, despite being on a cable network and it's beating all comers, partly because of Kat's presence. She's also a Fox News contributor and shows up on a lot of other things. And of course, we're going to talk mostly today about her best-selling book, You Can't Joke About That, Why Everything is Funny, Nothing is Sacred, and We're All in This Together. So,
yeah.
Kat, let's start by giving me the elevator pitch for the book.
Sure. Okay, so there's this idea among too many people that the dark, serious subjects or things even like religion, there's these sacred subjects that you can't joke about, right? And I think that those are actually the most important subjects to be able to joke about, because those are the ones that need healing the most. There's this idea that if you're pro-free speech, you're saying, I can say whatever I want. If you don't like it, fuck you. And that's true. But it also ignores the way that comedy and free speech can bring us closer together, because it can provide healing powers to tough, dark situations and also bring people who have gone through those things closer together.
All right. I'm thinking of my extended family, who I'm kind of glad they're not.
Yeah.
We're not all that together. But we're going to talk about the healing power of comedy in a second. But first, let's explain your rabid defense of free speech, because one of the things that's great about this book is that, I mean, it's funny. It's an interesting memoir as well as a kind of manifesto, but it is, pardon my gametes, but it's a balls out defense of free speech.
Balls. Yeah.
Okay. So what is it about free speech that you think is basically inviolable? Why is free speech so important as a principle?
Because if that's not your principle, then inherently you're saying that there should be someone else who decides what you can and cannot say. And there's nothing to me that's scarier than that. I mean, and I'm somebody who, it's like I've never been the target of hateful speech. I mean, I get some of the most disgusting stuff directed at me every day, like whether it's mean or whether it's deeply kinky sexual from men who you look at their Instagram and it's like a picture of them with their grandkids.
Yeah,
I'm like, okay, does your wife know you're on here, you sick fuck?
And with the exception of Anthony Weiner, probably not, right?
Right, probably not. But to me, it's like when people say, okay, well, what about this speech and what about this speech? And then my question to those people always is, okay, well, then who would you like to see making that decision? It drove me nuts throughout the entire Trump presidency how many people would call for hate speech laws, but then also say that Trump is literally Hitler. So how can you have those two views at the same time? So you want the government to be controlling speech, the same government that you yourself just said you think the figurehead or the head of the executive branch is literally Hitler. And you don't see how those two don't make sense together. If anything, the people who really hated Trump and thought he was Hitler should have came out of that presidency more for free speech. But that's just not how it worked out.
So what about, in the book, you run through a bunch of different examples of people who got pilloried for bad speech. Kathy Griffin is one, right? The comedian who I'm a big fan of. I think she's very funny. I think My Life on the D List was great.
Loved it,
But she, as I think the audience will remember, she got in big trouble, including bounce off of Twitter, but then put on a no-fly list and was being harassed by the TSA and by the government for having done a kind of stupid stunt where she had a kind of mannequin head of Trump, a severed head, et cetera. Yeah. You defended her speech. How did and that must have been hard at a Fox in a Fox context, right?
Yeah, I did. I wrote a column about it for National Review at the time. And because at the time there was people, I mean, it was a pretty common take on conservative Twitter that she should be, you know, prosecuted for this. And like you said, we're talking about nobody really thought, no sane person really thought that the star of My Life on the D-List, as you mentioned, was actually planning to assassinate the president. So I think that you could say you thought it was gross. You could say you didn't like it. But saying that it's not protected speech is, that's a super dangerous take, in my opinion, especially because we are talking about Kathy Griffin. She made a career being, I mean, when she won an Emmy, she got up there and said, I think something like, suck it, Jesus, this award is my God now. Something along those lines. I quoted it directly in my book, but we can't really be shocked that she did something like this. And again, conservatives, a lot of them who consider themselves free speech, said, okay, but this should be prosecuted. It's like, well, no, because the First Amendment, the main purpose of it is to criticize people in power without government retaliation as a check on the government. So I don't care how you feel about it. You have to stand against it to make sure that that's never used against you in the future.
So one of the other things you talk about, because there, you know, I think most of the people in this audience probably are like, okay, yeah, speech shouldn't be banned, but then maybe certain types of speech should be disapproved of in such a way it's almost the same as banning it. Or one of the examples that you talk about in your book is blackface in old TV, actually not even old TV shows. We're not talking about Amos and Andy, but we're, you know, relatively recent sketch comedy where when these shows go up on places like Hulu or Netflix or whatever, they've pulled the episodes that deal in blackface, even though without exception, it's a critique of the world that gave us blackface. But talk a little bit about why, you know, I'm blanking on the exact title of the chapter right now, but it's something like nothing should ever disappear.
Yeah, don't erase anything.
Yeah,
right?
Including blackface.
Yeah, in the summer of 2020, they called it, I think the New Yorker wrote a piece called, like, you know, saying how many different streaming services pulled episodes of things. I mean, different series. I mean, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, 30 Rock, How I Met Your Mother. there was so many different episodes.
Who knew?
The interesting thing about How I Met Your Mother was there was somebody who is more on the left, who her name, I don't remember, is in the book, who was saying, you know, we shouldn't erase anything because then we can't talk about it. We can't have that conversation. And I agree with that. But the example that she gave was the Yellowface episode of How I Met Your Mother, where they sort of dressed up as, you know, Kung Fu masters. And there was this debate at the time of, is this Yellowface? Is this just silliness? But she actually got the character wrong that was actually dressed like that, because it's a lot harder to have those conversations when it doesn't exist anymore. And the past, you know, it happened whether you acknowledge it or not. And there's no purpose for wanting to erase things except for wanting to dilute. It's kind of the same thing as if you don't like how your life is going, you want to go out and get fucked up and forget all about it. That doesn't mean that your life's any better. It means you're just ignoring it. And it's always better to have more information rather than less.
And that doesn't even count the time that you get fucked up and then do blackface.
Yeah, right? True.
Yeah. Which you, I want to point out in the book, she says that she has never done blackface.
No.
So you should be scanning all of her social feeds. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, we live in a time where within recent memory, there was this great moment where the governor of Virginia, Ralph Northam, or the ex-governor of Virginia, was shown to, he was either in blackface or in a KKK hood in his medical school yearbook.
Yes,
which is kind of insane.
Yeah, I've never done blackface. There is I write about this in my book too. I mentioned this book. I was a black Labrador retriever for Halloween when I was a child, because my cousin had a lab retriever. There is an uncomfortable photo of me with, like, when I took the ears off. But my brother was like, I'm going to cancel. I'm like 6 years old, maybe. You know, you don't even know what that is. But I was Pocahontas for Halloween when I was like seven.
Whoa.
I know.
What about, you also talk about Roseanne Barr, who now this, I mean, it's interesting because this, again, isn't legal prohibitions, but then there's, you know, questions about, okay, how does society organize what is acceptable and what is not? Roseanne Barr, who mounted what, you know, hands down the most successful reboot and comeback in recent TV history, where, you know, the new Roseanne show was a massive off the charts hit that hadn't been seen in decades, really. And then she tweeted out, you know, objectively racist stuff about a Barack Obama advisor. And that's it. What's your take on that broader kind of moment? Because she, I mean, it was a tweet, which she later said I was, you know, on Ambien and a couple of other things, which I don't know. I take Ambien almost every night and my Twitter feed never rises to that level of.
That's never happened
to
me.
So what should happen in that case? Is that not simply, you know, the vox public, I don't know, the public voice, the voice of the people saying, you know what, we don't want that kind of person in our life anymore.
You don't have to have any kind of person in your life that you don't want to have in your life. I think that Roseanne, what she's a very interesting example of, is just how much, you know, Twitter is pretty much never worth it. You know, it's like, not only do you not get paid, but you also can maybe get fired. But it's the
most dangerous drug in the world.
It's the dopamine hit. I mean, think of how much, like, every stupid thing most of us have ever done has been ultimately because of dopamine. What, you know, I mean, it makes you do dumb stuff because it feels good.
I'm going to say that for me, it was really alcohol and cocaine. But dopamine's in the top five.
You're better off not drinking. I love that. but also you alcohol, part of that is because of dopamine, right? That's part of why people seek out alcohol. She had everything going for her, but she still couldn't resist this one thing. I also think that what's the point, and Sarah Silverman said something about this once, what's the point of being a progressive if you can't allow for progress? She actually was speaking in the context of a friend of hers who used to be a literal Nazi, not the way people say literal Nazi now, but like an actual Nazi. Who now realizes how disgusting that is and says, I was looking for that. You know, if you can't progress and if you can't learn from mistakes and you're just canceled forever, then what are any of us even doing here? What are any of us doing anywhere in trying to educate people or in trying to express our beliefs or say, this is why this is, I think this is wrong and this is how I feel, if it doesn't matter anyway?
We're going to talk about the roots of your libertarianness in a bit, but I mean, you're very libertarian, but then I'm also thinking you treat this in the book, it's about a decade ago, whenever Fukushima was, Gilbert Gottfried, a very funny comedian who I think is dead now,
right?
he is not just figuratively dead, he's literally dead. But after the Fukushima nuclear power plant explosion, he was the voice of the Aflac duck, which was, you know, kind of a great gig, right? Nobody wants to lose that. And he made a bunch of jokes, you know, that were completely in keeping with his public career and persona about Fukushima. And he got bounced from Aflac. You would say definitely that's within Aflac's rights to say we want to distance ourselves. But is that a do you think that's a good decision?
No, because especially for a professional comedian, when it couldn't be more clear what your job is. I mean, he was making a joke about a tragedy to try to lighten it up. It's not like he was making the joke because he's like, fuck you, Japan, I don't care. I mean, that's like, if you're firing somebody, that's probably what you would be thinking, but nobody actually thinks that, you know? And he was so synonymous that whenever you see that duck, you hear the voice in your head, regardless of the fact that he was canceled and then he died. It is the job of comedians to make jokes about things that are dark, and we shouldn't be canceling them for doing that. I think that intention is what should matter. There's this really dumb idea out there now, and people actually say this. If someone says they're offended, that's all that matters, full stop. Attention doesn't matter. But how stupid is that? Of course intention matters. Of course it matters whether or not somebody was, you know, saying, I'm trying to make this joke here because I'm a comedian, or whether someone was saying, I'm making this joke because I like that natural disaster killed all those people, fuck those people. That's a very different, then that firing and that fuck you would be completely, and much more would be completely appropriate.
Right.
But there is that difference. We all know that, and it's dumb to pretend that we don't.
Is there a moment where, like, intention just kind of flew out the window? And, you know, was there a time when you know, people are like, okay, we're going to look, you know, at somebody says something that is considered awful or beyond the pale, but we're going to look at it holistically or with intention. I mean, clearly we don't tend to do that now. You know, what do you think has contributed to the idea people on the right and the left, you know, are just like ready to pounce whenever? Why is that?
I think that it's tribalism, and I think that it's fear. I think that people are afraid of being canceled, for sure. I think that it's also easy to pile on a Twitter, for example. If someone's getting canceled, you don't have to actually face that person when they get fired. You don't have to get up off the toilet. You just sit there and say, like, wow, quote tweet it, or this, you know, or something.
Yeah.
And like, and then you're like, I'm one of the good ones, you know? And if you have a side, there's certain sacred cows on your side that you need to show that you know, see as sacred, or else you might be jeopardizing your place on that side. And I think social media also makes that worse because, you know, you get to see all these people telling you fuck you when normally you wouldn't get to see that. And also because studies show that on at least Twitter and Facebook, they're, you know, historically moral, emotional words and grandstanding, they get more engagement than other posts, which think about how different that is from real life, right? If you had a friend who would only like talk like that, you wouldn't want to hang out with them anymore. But on social media, it's actually rewarded.
We could all come up with our own list of the things that progressives or left-wingers will pounce on and what conservatives do. You know, one great thing about being libertarian is that we're above it all.
Yeah.
What are, you know, are there particular things you think that libertarians are just awful on, where they always jump into, you know, kind of either pile on or dismiss a person's intention or the larger meaning?
I think I'm very careful not to. And I know that because I've defended free speech even when people were, you know, saying real. I've been people have tried to cancel me more than once for, and it's always over the dumbest shit too. But I'm like, okay, that's fine. You can totally say that. I think the ones on the left are obvious, like the this or that, the woke. But obviously the right has theirs too, which can be things like religion, the nuclear family, things like that, socially conservative things that when I make fun of them, people tell me that I'm evil and I'm going to hell. And I'm like, okay. So I don't think that I think that there's good, you know, everyone has sacred cows, right? Everybody has things that there might be a joke that you don't like, but there's a difference between saying I don't like that or that hurt my feelings and saying, making the jump to, and therefore you're a bad person, or you shouldn't have a job. It's okay to have feelings. I have a lot of feelings. I'm a very sensitive person, but I don't expect the world to revolve around and conduct itself in accordance to my feelings. And I hate the word snowflake because really you're a bully if that's the way that you feel. You're self-obsessed and you're a bully.
Let's talk about the big trauma that energizes your book. And this is your death of mother, the death of your mother in her late 50s.
Yes.
From, how do you pronounce it?
Cardiac amyloidosis.
Okay, what is that?
Super rare disease. Your body creates a protein your liver can't break down. It builds up in your organs. It mostly affects black men. So my mom's a girl, and like, I'm not mixed, if you can't tell. Like, she's white. So it was really unexpected. She died at 57, just about 3 weeks after she was formally diagnosed. And I obviously it was awful and traumatic. And I felt that in addition to it being devastating, it was also isolating because I could tell how scared people were to talk to me after that happened because they were so scared of saying the wrong thing. And it's like, I felt like I couldn't have a real conversation with anybody. And it's some of the shit people would say would be so like, oh, at least you got to say goodbye. And it's just like, bro, like, what do you say to people who die in car accidents? You know, like, oh, at least she wasn't like torn limb from limb in front of you and set on fire. You're not helping, you know? And then also, I felt that joking about it was helpful. My mom was joking about herself dying as she was dying. And I felt like people, and I didn't feel like that, people would actually shit on me for dealing with that it that way. The first Mother's Day after my mom died, you know, I was sad, but I felt bad. I didn't want to say anything. I was like, ugh. The second one, I'm still sad because it's like you see all the Instagram, all the people are like out to brunch with like, you can only do that with like living people. And I posted a picture of my laundry basket, a bottle of Tide. And I was like, mom's dad going to do some laundry because I laughed and I, you know, felt a little better. People were shitting on me for that. They're like, this is offensive. This is disrespectful. I'm like, bitch, to whom? Because...
Yeah.
You didn't know her. Like, I came out of her body. You don't even, like, you don't know me at all or her. So I think that you're just giving decorum for its own sake a higher purpose than it deserves. And that's what I mean by you're actually hurting the people who you're trying to help. The standards of speech are supposed to be put into place to protect people like me who are going through it, but they actually ended up hurting people like me.
Do you think it would have been worse if she had died in a car accident?
What would people have said? No. They'd have been like, well, they probably would have said, you know what, they would have been like, at least you didn't have to see her suffer. Yeah. You know, it's like, dude, just be like, this sucks. You know,
you wrote in your book, I was able to manage my misery because I was doing comedy. And you talk about how the harder something is to talk about, the funnier it you should be about it. You also marshal some, you know, psychology studies and things like that to talk about the healing power. May be a little too woo-woo, but, like, you know, that this is actually cathartic and helpful. Can you discuss that a little bit?
Absolutely. And I'm unfortunately, like, I have no beliefs. Like, I'm not, I mean, in terms of religion, right? Like, yeah. I'm not one of those people that's not a Christian, but then replace it with astrology. Like, I don't have, like, I'm just, you know.
Well,
I'm like
you were raised Catholic.
I was raised so Catholic. Yeah. And I write about that in my last book. I am not a Catholic anymore. Or in my last chapter, rather. But it's, you know, I write about how comedy is my religion, actually, in the last chapter, because it provides a lot of the same things physically, right? Like these chemicals that are released, the feel-good chemicals in your body that can be healing. Literally, it can help your immune system. And then the way that it can bring people together, it actually is healing in the physical sense and not just the emotional sense. And there's proof of that, that even people who are terminally ill, they say that talking about it in a funny way, they rate that higher than talking about in a solemn way, but people still say you can't do that, except for, you know, the people actually going through it and the people who study those people.
Do you think people are starting to come around to your point of view, or is that just, it really is never going to win the day?
You know, I'm very extreme with it. And if you've read the book, so Guy Benson from Fox, he interviewed me. He had about the book.
He's a laugh riot.
Too. Yeah, he can be. His husband's much funnier. But he.
Well, that's because his husband's dying. We're not supposed to tell. That's his, secret. Don't.
His, yeah. He said, Kat, some of this stuff, especially chapter five. I don't know if you guys read chapter five. An emergency bowel surgery. I had a shit bag for 5 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Title of the chapter is shit bag.
Yeah, I had and I had it reversed at the beginning of January, and then I had complications where blood was gushing out of my ass so bad that I needed a transfusion, and this was on January 6th.
Wow.
Like, yeah. That one. And but that's
insurrection.
Right, but yeah. Here's the thing. Here's the thing. It was the most pain I've ever been in, but, like, that's fucking hilarious, right? I forever I didn't want to talk about it, though, because I don't want people to be like, oh, like, was that okay? Like, no, I'm not okay. Yeah. I have this, like, gaping wound in my stomach. I can't even see my belly button. Like, I'm not okay. Like, I'm not okay, bro. No. But every time I had to watch, like, different politicians cry on TV about, I was like, I bet you my January 6th was worse than yours. But he asked me, why do you share? And if you think that was graphic, I get very detailed about the blood gushing out of the ass and the shit bag and all the mechanics of that. It's quite informative. And he said, why did you get into that much detail? And I said, because I didn't want to say you can joke about everything and no subject off limits and then make something off limits where I could have been open about it instead.
Right. One of the things that you talk about, and we're going to do a little bit of bio in a second, and then we're going to go to Q&A. But before we get to that, one of the things that I thought was interesting in the book is that you talk about sexism in comedy and patriarchy. And these are not things that we normally associate with people on Fox News, right? Really going hard on the patriarchy and whatnot. But you say we do live in a patriarchy, which is less of a political statement, more of a fact, when you accept that one definition of the word patriarchy is controlled by men of a disproportionate large share of power, which is just objectively true. And you you quote a 1965 New York Times review of Joan Rivers. This is kind of amazing, where it says, Joan Rivers, a new comedian of ripening promise, who opened at midweek for a two-week run at the Bitter End, is an unusually bright girl who is overcoming the handicap of a woman comic, looks pretty and blonde and bright, and yet manages to make people laugh.
Yeah.
You know, that's just great. And it's worth reading again. But, you know, to go to your point about progress, how, you know, talk about how far we've come since then, both in comedy or kind of the world in terms of patriarchy. And, but you're right, you know, that you list some of the things that you've encountered. You know, how far have we come and where do we need to go?
Right. We've come very far, right? Which is why I've always found it to be actually kind of low-key sexist when people fixate on the, you know, woman in comedy thing. Like, because even Joan Rivers going through that, that wasn't because she was a woman in comedy. That's because she was a woman in the 60s. It was a reflection of what women everywhere were going through. I mean, women couldn't even have a credit card at that time. You can have, because, you know, you can have a, you could be denied that because you have your husband open your bank account. So I think that also, I love the patriarchy thing because the guys who will say this is not a patriarchy, even though statistically there's way more men in positions of power than women. But then they're also like, I'm a numbers guy. It's like, no, you're not. But I think that it's important to acknowledge these things. But I think what's missing, or the pendulum is in a bit in the wrong direction in today's feminism, it focuses a little too much on what's being done to women and looking at it as a sort of excuse for why we're not where we want to be, and not enough of a focus on fucking doing it anyway. And Joan Rivers, I've always looked up to because she very much was like that. She was like, don't talk to me about being a pioneer. I'm still breaking barriers and so on and so forth. And that doesn't mean that the sexism is not real. I've gone through all kinds of things, which I do detail in that chapter. But also, I want to be, the ultimate goal is to be respected as a human being, just like any human being is. And, you know, take pride in the things that I've been able to do anyway and focus on what I'm going to do and how I'm just getting started and how I was a Boston Market cashier 12 years ago. And this is fucking amazing. And I'm going to keep going.
What was your favorite dish at Boston Market?
Oh, so thank you. Oh, this is a great question.
A lot of Boston Market fans out there.
Yeah.
They're hard to find now, right? Are there any left?
There's one around, the one that I worked at closed. Yeah. I quit like a week before Thanksgiving, which was a dick move on my part. But I got a job as a waitress. And at that time, the difference between minimum wage and minimum wage plus tips, I was like, I'm rich. Like, I was so excited. But the if you mix the chicken noodle soup and the chicken tortilla soup together, it's very good. And when you mix
that sounds like cultural appropriation.
No, but
I don't know.
Okay, what about
I'm uncomfortable even hearing about it.
Mixing the mac and cheese and the cream spinach together is also very good.
Yeah. All right. That's good to know. Let's talk about your bio. You're from Michigan. You were born in 1988. You went to Hillsdale College. What was your experience at Hillsdale?
So I was not as socially conservative as vast majority of my classmates, right? I liked that Hillsdale was a small school, though. I mean, I got a lot of opportunities that I would not have gotten otherwise. Because, I mean, so I had an internship at Hillsdale where I think that they weren't really sure if they wanted to give it to me or not at the Washington Times. Not because I wasn't a good writer, but because of my presentation of myself or whatever. I mean, I'm a wacko. I'm like, I'm not conservative in a social sense. I swear a lot. I don't have the best manners, maybe. I can't imagine myself working in a traditional office ever again. But I went there and, you know, I had 10 front page articles in 10 weeks. So I did a good job and I eventually got a job at Washington Times after Boston Market. It was good. I learned a lot. And I think I'm a better writer because it was a small school and the professors would actually read your writing and give you actual feedback.
You were an
on
English
it.
Major,
I
right?
was an English
who's,
major.
Who's your favorite author or book that, and does it inspire you to this day?
So the book that I reread every few years is Rabbit at Rest. I love the John Updike books. I love all four of them. You have to read all four of them to get, you know, really get everything out of
to really understand the patriarchy.
Yeah, I mean, look, because of the individual sentence structure, though. I mean, at the end of the day, the book's like a guy, you know, living his life, but he has little sentences that I've underlined and I've kept with me throughout my entire life. And I like to go back and reread the book and see what I underlined at another time. And I'm like, oh, I remember that thing I was dealing with, and now things are different. So those are probably my favorite.
Before we continue with the recent interview with Kat Timpf, I want to tell you about today's sponsor, BetterHelp Online Therapy. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P. If you're having any sort of trouble in your life, you might benefit from therapy. And I'm here to tell you that BetterHelp is a great service, whether you're feeling anxious, depressed, or just like you're not the best version of yourself. BetterHelp is entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists anytime at no additional charge. I know it's a great service because I used it myself for about 2 years, and it really made a difference. It helped me work through a lot of stuff. So visit betterhelp.com/TRI today, and you'll get 10% off your first month. The TRI stands for The Reason Interview, so make sure to get that discount on your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/TRI. And now, back to The Reason Interview.
You also did stints. You worked, you did traffic reports in California the helicopter.
Yes.
Yeah. Why were you fired?
For giving the wrong directions.
I totally get it. That's one of the things holding women back.
Yeah.
By the way.
So that's the thing. And they did give the job to a man. But that was totally their call. I mean, I have a great radio voice, but not sending people into traffic is a pretty key part of that job for which I just
Are you worried that like Google Maps is kind of making traffic reporters less important, right? They're
probably
kind of like travel agents or dry cleaners. That's
probably. Yeah. And I mean, that was a job where I made $15 an hour. Again, the waitress job that's where I really made my money.
You also did stints at National Review and Barstool Sports.
Yes.
What was it like working there? And it does seem like most of the places you've worked are kind of right of center. Mm-hmm. What explains that? Because you're very libertarian in word and deed and presentation. What is it like? Why do you think you've been at mostly right-leaning organizations?
Yeah, I think it's probably because Hillsdale. I think that's probably because I went to Hillsdale and then I had those internships at conservative publications and then they led to more conservative publications and then another. But I also, like you said, I've not changed my beliefs at all. I've not hidden my beliefs at all. Mm-hmm. I'm not conservative. I'm libertarian completely. I'm not libertarian leaning. I'm libertarian. And I've not swayed on that at all. I've also not ever had any interest in having any kind of platform or where I would be even discouraged from saying what I really believe or think about something.
Yeah, is it hard to be a libertarian, like an unapologetic libertarian at Fox?
See, it's a weird thing because obviously I have some takes where, I mean, this is the show that airs tonight. They were talking about the trans prisoner, she's getting a free vagina from the government.
Wow.
And they're talking about the waste of money.
I think it was Milton Friedman who said there are no free vaginas.
Yeah. And everyone's all, you know, this is an outrage, free vagina, our taxpayer money. And I'm like, well, it's an outrage that she's even in prison because it was for a drug offense. So if you're going to get mad about wasting money, then like, why are we locking up this person just because she doesn't party the way the government says is okay? I do get a lot. I'll get heat, you know, from certainly people on the right. But there's people on the left. They're like, she works at Fox News. Fuck her. I want to talk to her. So it's like, everybody hates me.
Well, that's good.
You know?
Why, you know, how did you become libertarian? Were you bitten by something how did you become libertarian?
Well, I was lucky. My dad is pretty libertarian. So I kind of started out that way, but I think it's just the alternatives, right? I mean, paying attention, I guess. I mean, look at how there really isn't a party that stands for anything. I mean, the right are the anti-war people now. That was the thing I got yelled at a lot by people at Fox and the audience forever, were my non-interventionist views on foreign policy, being critical of the FBI, things like that. And now those are Republican takes. So it's like, if you really pay attention, you realize that these parties, they get us to play against each other, and all the while they are enriching themselves and gaining more power for themselves while we continue to argue on their behalf, who are for most people just strangers to us, and alienating one another who we know in real life.
Given when you were born and when you graduated college and stuff, do you see any signs that might change? Some of us older libertarians remember a time when it seemed like libertarianism was gaining ground. Do you think it is, or what needs to happen for libertarianism to kind of become the next thing or, you know, for more people to agree with, this is the way we should be thinking about stuff.
Yeah, I think that there's this misconception that you're somehow heartless if you say that the government shouldn't be solving a certain problem, that it means that you don't care about that problem. When really, to me, it's so the opposite. It's like, how we're talking about this problem and the government is involved, how is that going? And kind of rebranding it in a certain way, because I think most people, I mean, it's gonna be Biden versus Trump again. I don't know anybody who's like super jazzed about that, but people feel like there's no choice.
I'm just waiting to see them walk up to the stage and see whoever makes it without falling. You know, okay, you're the president for the next 8 years.
It's just, it's like, are you fucking kidding me? Like every single election. And then people say that I'm throwing my vote away. For a while, so I didn't used to vote at all. And then now I've started voting where I vote libertarian, including when there's no libertarians on the ballot at all. I go and I write in my cat's name for everything.
And who, what is Sheen's the cat's
Timpf.
Name?
Okay. He's still alive, 13 years old, still alive. I've had him since I was at Boston Market. And
he made it out of the kitchen, right?
He made it, yeah.
Okay.
Because I don't want them to think that I'm not voting because I want to get off the couch. I'm not voting because... I'm voting, but I see voting for either major party as me being complicit in my rights and the rights of others being taken away. And I don't want to be complicit in that.
Okay, great. Let's open it up to audience Q&A. If you could form a line, and if we could maybe have a reason person help. Okay, sir, you're good. Okay, ask your question, but make it a question. You, yes, go.
So this is addressed as a libertarian and a view of our Bill of Rights, the rights of free speech. When they were writing the Constitution and the idea of the Bill of Rights with Madison and the Treasury dude.
Hamilton.
Hamilton, yes, thank you. They based on the purpose of the Bill of Rights and the idea that the government was role was to protect the citizens from these things, but also protect, the idea of, I mean, either way, not only from the government taking away the rights, mm-hmm. but the government was also supposed to protect the rights for other citizens from other entities within the country.
Okay.
Itself. How do you think the role should be for government in this aspect, or should or what should be done for this?
Obviously, that's the way it's supposed to be, right? But I think the government throughout the years has really gotten people to feel comfortable with or even be complicit in giving up their own rights by using fear as a tool. It's always like, okay, national security, so therefore you have to give up these rights. Or if you don't agree to this, you're not a patriot and you hate your country. You'd be afraid of the bad guys over there and not realizing how many threats to our liberty are really within our own government.
Thanks. Next question.
First, I love that you love the rabbit books. I reread them all the time. They're filled with irreverent jokes. I recommend it.
Question, please. Okay. We have John Updike's unacknowledged twin.
Yeah.
Please, just like a question.
Nick, would you have to respect? I recommend the sequel, Rabbit Remembers.
Okay.
That gets to my question about Sarah Silverman, related points. She told a great Holocaust joke. But then I thought, well, she's a Jew. You're a Shiksa. Could you tell something?
Okay.
Second, related question. But then she told a joke about being a white person, which I thought was more daring. And then third.
Because she's a Jew and Jews are not white?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Dick, why did God make Gentiles? Because somebody has to be dumb enough to pay retail.
Okay. Very good.
But aside from that, she's told a joke about being a white person, but she is white. Has her humor gone downhill ever since she became sort of left-leaning? So related questions about Sarah Silverman, if you could answer.
Great. Thank you.
Sure. I don't know about her humor versus not, but I think that she's been somebody who actually has a pretty reasonable view comparatively of this stuff. She says, you know, there's things I feel bad about and I apologize, and then there's things I don't feel bad about, so I don't. And I think that's it's ridiculous just how rare that point of view is. I think a lot of people just apologize because that's what their PR person told them they should do. And that's created a huge there's a huge disconnect between what people actually believe and what people say they believe, and there's studies that back that up that I write about. We've created these standards that none of us, or most of us, actually don't even believe. So I think being honest about what you find acceptable and not, I think is actually a great thing.
Yeah, and you talk a little bit in the book about how people who apologize for things they clearly really aren't sorry for,
yeah,
it doesn't work. They end up, it's bad outcomes.
No, because you can tell when you're being, I mean, I read about Selena Gomez, even though I'm a little old to know who that is. She apologized to Hailey Bieber for something. She said, "I don't even know what I did, but I'm literally so sorry." I'm like, then you can't be, because you don't know what you did. And then it makes it harder actually for people to actually apologize when they do mean it, because we're so oversaturated with these apologies that we're just like, okay, whatever.
Well, maybe she was raised Catholic, so yeah, she knows she's guilty of something.
I still have that guilt. Right? I still have that guilt every day. I'm like, I know I did something wrong, I just don't know what it is yet.
Next question.
I teach within a communication studies program. This gets back, it's changing the topic back to the internet, to Twitter and social media. And in that curriculum, we've had like interpersonal communications. I'm wondering if you think that maybe middle school level, there should be some kind of etiquette course for social media, because like, I can't imagine but how it might be for someone to be unfriended, or for a kid to be on alcohol and fentanyl and send a message to the girl or the guy that didn't want to, and they ought to, you know, get it in the middle of the night when they should be sleeping. Do you think there should be some kind of interpersonal social media, like the dangers and the dopamine, and, you know, like we keep liquor in the cabinet, it's like, and nobody starts being an alcoholic at 30. They all start when they're 12 or 13 or 14. At this
time. So in middle school.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
I think it could be available. I don't think it should be mandatory. I think it's also, it can be kind of hard, right? I mean, I feel like if your parents aren't paying attention, then you might be kind of fucked. It's ultimately, I think, up to individual parents to decide what is best for their kids. Like, you know, I went through the DARE program, even though my dad, who was a libertarian, was like, I don't want her to go to that government propaganda. And I was like, Dad, but everyone's gonna make fun of me. And I ultimately won out. And like, he was fucking right about that. So
what do you think are the limits? This comes up in a lot of libertarian discussions. What are the limits of parents' rights when it comes to something, say, like trans identity? Parents don't have absolute control over their children, but they have most control, right?
Yeah, and I feel
how do you kind of work through difficult issues like that?
Yeah, I think ultimately kids belong to their parents, not to the state.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think, who are like all these trans kids? You know, it is such a small segment of the population for how much people talk about it and how loud people scream over each other about it, to the point where I just feel like it's a lot easier than talking about some other issues for a lot of people.
Because it doesn't actually affect.
Because it doesn't actually affect them. And also because another thing with the binary thinking is, once you pick a side, that's probably what's so attractive to people about it, is all your thinking's kind of done for you. You just wait to see what all your buddies say, and then you say that. You don't have to think at all.
Next question.
Really looking forward to reading your book, Kat. Sounds great.
It is.
Thanks for confirming that. So I want to give you an opportunity to get yourself in trouble.
It's very generous. Very generous of you, sir.
You pointed out some examples of cancel culture stuff that's coming from the left, and maybe even from the Trumpian side with the Kathy Griffin thing. But can you tell us a little bit more about cancel culture stuff that comes from the libertarian side?
He asked me that.
I wanted to go into that a little bit more. You know, some examples that you thought about or dealt with. But I mean, one thing that occurs to me that I want to just put in front of you is there is one aspect of, you know, there has been some folks that I know. I do a lot of work with free market think tanks that try to address climate from a free market perspective, right? And a lot of those guys who have some pretty good ideas have gotten
pushed out of organizations on the right from people who present as libertarians or free market people who don't agree with anything that addresses climate because they think climate is real. So they want to shut down the conversation and shut these people out. And I know people would be forced out of jobs and forced to leave think tanks and, like, you know, shut out of conferences.
Okay. So what's the...
What do you think of that? What do you think of the larger issue? What are some of the other things that are where the libertarian movement is not necessarily living up to its free speech ideals and, you know, open engagement with ideas kind of ideal?
Thank you.
Yeah, I think that open engagement of ideas is a huge thing for me personally. I mean, I have friends of many varying backgrounds. I mean, I have friends who are obviously Republican, friends who are Democrats. I also have friends who are, like, straight up Marxists, like super left progressives. And, like, they come to my home. So to me, it's not something that I personally struggle with. And I think that I just try to live by example. I also think that in this book, when you read it, you will find that I talk a lot about human shit, right? Like stuff like death, stuff like illness, things. If you shut people out sometimes over a political issue like that or a disagreement or one thing, then you might be missing other issues that are even more human that you could be connecting with those people on.
Do you feel like, even in your career, we're more politicized now, right? Than we started, like everything is political. You know, why is that happening and how do we maybe pull back from that so we can, you know, and this is libertarian dogma kind of saying, well, politics can matter, but we want it to be a small part of our life, not everything being hyper-politicized.
Everything, and including, I really started to notice this, when people started getting fired from reality TV shows for saying things that were offensive. I'm not watching reality TV to see good people, like, do good things. I mean, it's completely batshit crazy. And I think that it has gotten a lot worse. And I think that it's going to take more people to stop being afraid. There's nothing that I don't touch on in this book, as anybody who read it knows. So I'm trying to start these conversations.
Great. Thank you. Next question.
Hi.
I was born Bill Schultz, but I currently identify as Joanne Osagie.
Yeah.
And I hope you respect my pronouns. And first of all, none of you guys listened to Nick's request. Those were speeches.
Yeah.
And land the plane, guys. But my question for you is, I thoroughly enjoyed your appearance with Bill Maher on Club Random.
Mm-hmm.
And I want some behind-the-scenes anecdotes. Ideally salacious.
Oh, man, I have nothing salacious. Sorry, we weren't there that long, but Keith, who's right over here, sorry, mm-hmm. He's also in the book. He went with me. It was so much fun. His estate is so fucking huge. You go in there and there's like one building that's the green room and then another building that's like the actual, the Club Random where they film it. And you go in there and I did a shot of tequila in the green room before and I had some Mickey Elders on the set. But you go in there and he never tells you you're starting. Like, he just does. And so, and you're the only two people that are in there. So I think that that was something that was interesting. But then I came back to the green room and Keith was, you had a good time. He was hammered.
It is a phenomenal podcast series. Your episode is great. Bill Maher is really emerged over the past decade or so as like a true free speech absolutist. How do we get more people in the public eye to be like that, do you think?
Again, it has to be by example because the fact that so many people actually feel this way but won't say it, and the reason is just that they're afraid, that kind of really tells you everything that you need to know. And I think getting back to the standard of intention being what we weigh here and also saying you can say, hey, you know what, that hurt my feelings without letting it be followed by, therefore, you shouldn't be employable.
Right. Next question.
Speaking of example, it seems that something just went out of the air of this whole, like, no, you, when Colin died at the end of the Bush years.
I'm sorry, say that again?
It's something when happened when George Colin died.
Okay.
No one really stepped up as, like, you know, like, as a Colin or Lyndon Bruce type figure. Like, they were, like, the heroes and, like, even among the more partisan people, like, you know, the liberals' heroes in the Bush era were Colbert and John Stewart. You know, it's like that was
okay.
Like the thing of, like, you know.
So, is there a question?
Yeah, So like, why hasn't, so, you know, those guys are still around. Colbert and Stewart are still around, but they're not doing that sort of thing. Like, why hasn't a figure like that emerged? Like,
okay.
Yeah, I think a lot of it has, like I said earlier, has to do with the internet and social media. You could have people shit on you in their homes and not see it all the time.
And in a libertarian world, that's kind of the future we want. As long as it's people shitting on themselves in their homes.
Yeah.
Anything that's peaceful.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can say like, oh, I don't care what anybody says, but obviously we're all human and everybody does.
Well, do you think this is a widely, circulated observation that, you know, a lot of people on the left were anti-war when George Bush was in office. And then when Obama got elected as an anti-war president, but kind of kept doing the same thing.
Right.
The anti-war left was like, eh.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, is it as simple as that people like Stephen Colbert, they just are more, kind of in sync with liberal kind of speech codes. So they're not going to be oppositional when their people are more in power.
Yeah, but I think even to Jon Stewart's credit back in the day, for a while there, it was unacceptable to question the Iraq war.
Right.
Right. Because then you weren't a patriot.
Yeah.
And he wasn't afraid to do that and make jokes about that. Again, I think it has gotten worse now. I don't think you can look at, as you mentioned, Obama got a Nobel Peace Prize. And I went and I made a video years ago right after that happened. Or I went to, I believe, USC. And I was like, do you think Obama deserves this Nobel Peace Prize? And everyone said, yes, of course. And I said, why? And everybody was like, I don't know. Or like, because he's a cool dude. Or like, which is sure. But it really didn't turn out to be that way, as you pointed out. A lot of droning going on and whatnot. Because I think it becomes a lot about figureheads and groupthink, and people don't actually question these things. And just watching how the right is now, like, they're the anti-war people, but then, like, if things flipped, I'm sure that's not how it's going to stay. It's going to flip around again.
And I mean, it seems to me that, vaccines.
Yeah.
That if Trump had been like, you know what, I did Operation Warp Speed and I love these vaccines. Look at me, I'm getting vaccines. People on the right would be super pro-vaccine and people on the left would be very anti. And it's kind of a roll of the dice. But the important thing is that you pick a side and stay with
Absolutely. And I think it's worse than even just being expected to pick a side. I think it's people don't understand that there are people who didn't pick a side. A while back, I was saying something about, I think it was guns. And if, if our rights don't matter, then none of them matter, something like that. And some popular one of those Twitter accounts that just watches Fox News all day and posts little clips was like shitting on me. Like, how could I say this when I am pro-life? The thing is, I'm not. Like, I'm pro-choice. I've never said otherwise. But it's impossible for people to even think that that would be, to the point where they're going to put me on blast without even Googling Kat Timpf pro-life and seeing that nothing comes up.
when it comes to comedians, is there a generational shift? I mean, people like Bill Maher, certainly George Carlin, I mean, they are boomer comedians and they, kind of reveled. You can take it as far as you want or throw it away, but, they liked poking the mainstream and being contrary. Is that not as big a thing for people under 40, do you think, comedians?
Yeah, I think it's, getting more sad with the younger people. And I'm not just saying this because I do have a lot of boomer fans. But I think, I even, when I was writing my chapter about how self-deprecation in the form of comedy is really good for you, I did a little search on it. And there was so many of those college newspaper pieces about how jokes about yourself are bad all the time. You should do that. Love yourself, etc. And I have been reporting on this stuff long enough to know that, unfortunately, those kids then graduate and bring their ideas to the rest of us. So I do think so. I really do think that's the case. And I think we're not really prepared for just how absolutely dumb things are going to get leading up to and through the 2024 election.
Well, and Biden and Trump at least won't understand any of it. Right?
They have
that going for them. We've got time for one more question.
I'm a big advocate for free speech, but I'm a big advocate for one thing. I'm growing up as a man to learn that insults grow people. So what is your opinion about someone accepting an insult and growing from that?
Yeah, no, that's so I think that's definitely possible. I think that I certainly have grown from a lot of the insults that I've had. I think obviously there's a difference between comedy and insulting someone to be a dick, which are very different things. But I think that just goes, you know, everything's always kind of what you make it to a certain extent. And I've found that when it comes to insults, the things that what's helped me is I sort of insult myself in like a funny way. So it takes the power away from some of those insults. For example, someone can make fun of me for having no tits, but I've already made the joke that my bra size is double mastectomy. So like, it doesn't hurt as much. My mom had breast cancer. You can calm down. And also, whatever. I really have no tits, sir. Hmm. I'm wearing a very padded bra. It registers on a bathroom scale.
Hmm. All right.
One other question that I had is because you said as a female that this world is built on the legacy of the hard works that most men have done. But if the same results that a woman can do to do their work or whatever, build pipes, if that could be our reality, will you say the same thing?
I'm confused by the question.
Yeah, I'm not sure I got
if
that either.
Females can build the same structure that
right.
men did
okay.
in the days of laying pipes or building the train tracks. Will you say the same thing?
Yeah, I'm not talking about my physical ability to build a train track.
Females and a lot of feminists point to social structures of committing and producing.
Yeah.
Can I try maybe to segue into a thank you, sir.
Thank you.
But are there, you know, are there limits? I mean, part of libertarians, like, you know, it's kind of you can be whatever you want to be. You can try to be whatever you want to be.
I would never say you can be whatever you want to be.
Okay,
I
yeah.
can never
so,
lay train
you know,
tracks.
What are the limits of, you know, male and female as kind of permeable categories?
Yeah, I mean, I think it totally depends. Obviously, by and large, biological males are stronger than biological right. females physically. Then obviously, there are obviously some men and women who are exceptions to that. But I mean, that's just an obvious truth.
But I mean, is the focus? I mean, from a libertarian perspective, the focus is more on the individual, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm sorry, we are done with the question and answers. I want, as a final comment, Kat, you towards the end of the book, you talk about Viktor Frankl, the Holocaust camp survivor who wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning. And you talked about how he, or you quote him talking about, you know, that the ultimate freedom is the freedom to choose one's attitude in any given circumstance or any given set of circumstances, which coming from somebody who survived a concentration camp, that's wow. You know, that's something that I think even a Christian could understand. would you talk a little bit about that? Like, why did you include that and how does that kind of, you know, energize or summarize what you're going for in the book?
Right. Because if you read the book, you'll understand that I don't mean like, oh, just look on the bright side. Like I've struggled with anxiety, depression my entire life. I still do. I still have days that are bad, but I choose to look for what's funny. And because I don't have what other people have in religion, all humans desperately, as he talks about, are on the search for meaning. I have meaning in those traumatic, awful experiences because of comedy, right? The shit bag, the guy breaking up with me in front of my dad at Coney Island a couple months after my mom died, you know, the struggling in Los Angeles, being broke and not having a bed and then losing my car and my apartment. Being able to turn that shit into a best-selling book was awesome. And that provided meaning to those experiences, especially a book that I've heard from so many people they've had meaning added to their own experiences or have learned from or related to in some way.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. I want to thank Kat Timpf for...
Thank you for having me. I don't want to clap for myself.
for joining the Reason interview. The book is You Can't Joke About That, Why Everything is Funny, Nothing is Sacred, and We're All in This Together. Kat, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
This has been the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. Before you do anything else, go to Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, and sign up, subscribe. We put out 2 episodes a week. Don't miss any of them. Or how about this? Make it super easy on yourself. Just go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. And while you're at reason.com/podcasts, check out the Reason Roundtable and the Soho Forum Debates, our other two great podcast series. I think you'll love them. If you like this one, you'll really love them. Thanks for listening.